Thank you, Dr. Burns. This is the Monadnock Summer Lyceum, hosted by the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire, and broadcast on New Hampshire Public Radio. We have some time for questions from the audience, and while the ushers collect them, let me begin by asking this. As a high school teacher, with a student in the audience, how can I get my students involved in the Floating Forest Project, and what exactly would they be doing?
That's a great question. There are a variety of ways that students can become involved in Floating Forests. First off, just going to the site and looking around, we have a very simple task for students to undertake. It's looking at images and circling forests, and then we tell you something about what you've just done. We tell you how much kelp that you found in that image. We tell you when the image was taken and where it was taken. So I've actually used this in freshman-level college courses, and I've had students go through and start to write down how much kelp are they seeing and where are they seeing it, at what time. And you'd be amazed, after only a few images, you begin to see patterns. You begin to see patterns across the years. You begin to see patterns across space. You begin to see patterns even within a year. In winters, maybe there isn't so much kelp. In summers, there's a lot of kelp. So there are a variety of ways that curricula can be shaped around those sorts of patterns that have to do with very basic kelp biology. Second, we have a site called ZooTeach. It's not ours, it's Zooniverse's site. So at ZooTeach, we are trying to actively collect curricula that educators are creating using different Zooniverse sites. And so we, at this point, we have our curriculum for elementary school students posted there already. And we're hoping to collaborate with high school, middle school, and even college teachers in the future to create more curricula to help students learn about kelp forests and use floating forests as a lens through which they can begin to interact with kelp forests. In fact, that's actually the biggest thing I'd say. It's a citizen science project. The science team that helped create Floating Forests is very invested in interacting with people. We're really excited about collaborating with high school teachers, with educators at all different levels, to try and find ways that we can help teach your students about kelp forests. So drop us an email. I'm sure we'll respond.
This is the big one, I guess. I'll give you the big question first. In the end, why does it matter if kelp beds change, other than the possible effect on our human population?
Mm-hmm. So why does it matter if kelp forests change? There are a number of reasons. Kelp forests form the foundation, or kelps in general, form the foundation of the ecosystems where they occur. So if we see a decline in kelps, we don't just see a decline in kelps. When we remove kelp from ecosystems, we see a cascade of changes to all of the other species in the ecosystem. So it's not merely that loss of kelps will affect services that you and I derive from kelps, but all of the other species will also change. They will lose habitat, and they will lose food. They will lose a place for their larvae to come in and settle. So we may see wholesale transition of these ecosystems were we to lose kelps.
Before we came out, we were talking about gametophytes. So the question is, you spoke about kelp seeds.
Mm-hmm.
Do kelps have a sexual process to produce those seeds?
That's a great question. So I talked about kelp seeds, and that was a bit of a simplification. Kelps have this pretty incredible life cycle. We call it a biphasic life cycle. What that means is that adult kelps are diploid, like you and me. They have two chromosomes. When kelps reproduce as diploids, they actually send out spores, and those spores are haploids, so they only have one set of chromosomes. Those spores, so this is an asexual process, and those spores go out and settle down on the seafloor and form these microscopic stages. That's what I referred to when I was talking about kelp seeds, but the technical name for them are gametophytes. And that's because each of these microscopic little gametophytes is either male or female. It's a haploid. Those gametophytes actually engage in sexual reproduction and create new diploid kelps. It's a really cool life cycle, where most algae go through some really bizarre and interesting alternation of generations, some really interesting life cycles. In fact, unlocking those great variety of life cycles has been the key to unlocking algal aquaculture in some systems. For a long time, for example, it wasn't known that nori, what we commonly use to wrap seaweed, undergoes that alternation of generations. And so efforts to farm nori in Japan weren't successful until somebody discovered that the alternate life history phase of the algae, of the alga that is nori, Porphyra, looks nothing like the adult. It looks completely different. And once that was discovered, and they were discovered that they were the same species, it was only then that farming of Porphyra for nori could really take off. So it's a whole bizarre and fascinating area of biology. Algae are really cool.
Is picking up kelp floating in the water to bring home to fertilize our gardens damaging to the ecosystem?
It's a great question. So is picking up detrital kelp actually damaging the ecosystem? First off, it's not rooted down, but that detrital kelp will often have a fate. So detrital kelp can feed, as I mentioned, urchins or other species on the seafloor. Detrital kelp can get washed offshore, and in fact, for example, up in Nova Scotia, we find that the detrital kelp can get shipped offshore, fall into these deep water trenches and feed a variety of the species there. We also find that kelps will often wash up onto beaches, and in fact, kelps can nourish beaches. They provide a food source for a variety of animals that can live on beaches. Picking up a single blade of kelp that you find and taking it home, probably not a big deal. But wholesale harvest, actually, harvesting can be done very responsibly. Again, as I mentioned, kelps recover very quickly. They grow very quickly. Kelp harvest is an active and growing industry, and there are a lot of interesting questions there. In fact, kelp farming has really started to take off in Maine recently. It's a really great industry. It provides a winter crop. It's a wonderful, wonderful source of food, wonderful source of fertilizer, as well as other products. So taking a single piece home, it's probably fine. But just recognize that that kelp is part of a whole tapestry, that the detritus can fuel a wide variety of other biological processes.
Okay, well, you've already answered one question, which is there a way to sustainably harvest kelp as a food source?
Yep.
So that was clever. Two with one. Okay.
Well, and I'd mention, I think that, you know, kelp harvesting has a very, very long history. You find kelp harvesting in Japan going back quite far. They have a very, very active kelp harvesting as well as kelp aquaculture industries. You find similar industries in Korea. And in fact, here in Maine, it's Maine Seacoast Vegetables does a wonderful and sustainable harvesting operation. Like I said, go to the Seaweed Festival and you'll really see the state of the art. Again, you know, my hat's off to Maine Sea Grant for funding all of that work into kelp aquaculture and kelp harvest. I think it's an interesting potential future crop for us, and we're seeing all sorts of great developments. For example, there was recently a Norwegian group that showed how the same kind of sugar kelp that we find here can be turned into biofuel quite efficiently. So a lot of possibilities for kelp.
Thank you. Okay, so does ocean acidity affect kelp?
Does ocean acidity affect kelp? That's a complex question, believe it or not, to which we don't have great answers yet. There are some studies that are just starting to come out that show that pH can affect, or ocean acidity can affect different parts of kelp's life history. However, I think the evidence is far from solid. What's interesting at this point is that changes in ocean acidity can affect a lot of the organisms around kelps. But at the same time, kelps themselves, by using a great deal of carbon dioxide, can actually alter local acidity. So there can be a halo of changes in acidity around kelp, and those changes vary from time of day to time of day, whether kelps are actively photosynthesizing and taking up CO2, or at night and when they are respiring. So how ocean acidification and changes in ocean acidity will impact kelps and kelp ecosystems, I think is actually quite an exciting and open frontier of research.
And I've got another ocean chemistry problem for you. The effects of dilution due to Arctic ice melting, Greenland glacier diminishing, and Antarctic glacier shrinking, is this change in salinity going to affect the kelp beds?
Mm-hmm. So will melting glacial ice or melting ice caps affect kelps? Again, I think this is a really great question. We've seen in some places the most immediate effect of melting ice on kelps isn't changes in salinity. It's actually having more light. So kelps in some places go all the way up into the Arctic. And there, many of these kelps sort of enter a quiescent phase over the winter as they're iced over. So there's no ice, there's no light, there's very little photosynthesis. Many of these kelps will then store up nitrogen over the course of the winter, and then when light comes in again, they'll begin actively growing quite rapidly. Some of my colleagues in Norway have found that those changes in light levels due to ice melting earlier and earlier can lead to quicker growth and can actually often lead to imbalances in the sort of carbon and nitrogen ratios in kelps and lead to them growing in some really funky ways in some places. They're adapted to deal with a certain amount of sunlight coming in a year. They're adapted to using their ambient nutrient stores. So changes in the timing of sea ice melt can have some very large consequences for how those beds grow and develop. In some places in the Arctic, we actually are starting to see kelps move in where they weren't there previously. Actually, this is a bit of a tangent. I find one of the exceptions that proves the rule about how climate change may affect kelp forests actually comes to us from South Africa. Due to patterns of ocean circulation around South Africa, parts of the coast there, rather than warming, are actually cooling due to changes in circulation from climate change. And in those cooling areas, we've actually watched kelp begin to move its range towards the equator. So it's kind of this fascinating phenomenon where this exception of a cooling waters kind of proves the rule of how changes in sea surface temperatures can affect kelps.
Thank you. Okay, so the final question is from me, and that is, could you tell a little bit about how you got involved in marine biology in the first place?
Sure. I got involved in marine biology from a very early age, basically shortly after birth. My aunt was a wonderful underwater photographer, and she spent a lot of time with me as a kid. And when we spent time together, often she would be going through slides from her last trip that she was either going to submit for publication or put together to give a talk herself. So I really grew up at her knee learning all about the ocean. And then I moved to Baltimore when I was still quite young, and my mother actually began working at the National Aquarium in Baltimore. So in some ways, I was kind of raised by the National Aquarium's volunteer department, you could say. So I spent a lot of time as a little kid just around the ocean, around marine biology. I started diving quite early on. Actually, that was a big transition. I began diving when I was 12 years old, and there is nothing quite like the first time you are down at 30 feet, breathing and looking at the sea around you. It's a transformative experience.
Thank you. So thank you again, Dr. Burns, for sharing your time and expertise with us today.
Thank you all. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum on New Hampshire Public Radio. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum presents a weekly series of lectures held at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire. For more information about the Lyceum, you can visit our website at www.monadnocklyceum.org. The program next Sunday will feature Meg Peterson, who will speak about Reclaiming the Core, Education for Social Beings and Idea Creators.